are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is the Alien Day Special 2020. Reproduction, a very important natural phenomenon, it's how we all got here today. Well, except for me, I'm comprised mostly of 3D printed components assembled in a lab. Not every species goes about reproduction the same way, especially not the xenomorph. In fact, they like to play pretty fast and loose with the rules, and they switch up their method of reproduction quite frequently. This is what we'll explore today in our third Alien Day special. How the xenomorph and related creatures have been able to multiply, which method is the most efficient. And, in addition to that, we will be examining real-world equivalents in nature, because this is Prometheus by Minute, and you know I love me some science. I believe this will be a lot easier to follow if I go in chronological order rather than in the release order of the films. I will not be acknowledging the expanded lore much, if at all, because, well, it's not canon, and my god, there's so much of it, and it's contradictory, and it's just... And before we begin, I would like to thank Clara, aka Mother of the Yutani Network, for giving me this suggestion for the theme of this special for 2020. We begin with Prometheus, of course, the earliest entry in this franchise, and with the mutagen, aka the black goo. The mutagen was discovered by humans in 2093, and by this stage it had clearly been used by engineers for a very long time. It's difficult to say when LV-223 was abandoned. The film suggests roughly 2,000 years ago. Any of the engineers appear unchanged in Alien Covenant. The technology is still compatible with the Juggernaut, and they seem to recognize it. Perhaps the implication being the engineers have more in common with ancient cultures, like Pharaonic Egypt, where we saw comparatively little change culturally and technologically over the course of millennia. It's almost as if their technology has come full circle, from a slow primitive culture to a rapidly expanding one, much like our own, to one that stabilizes again and slows down. This is interesting to consider, and makes a certain amount of sense. Right now, humanity is just beginning to explore our technological potential, so our culture is rapidly evolving. We seldom use phones for more than 5 years, or computers for more than 10. At least, not without upgrading parts. Whereas your parents, or perhaps your grandparents, had the same landline phone for decades because, well, it just receives and makes phone calls. What else do you need it to do? It's all it could do. But what happens when we reach the hard limits of physics? We're close to reaching that point now. The next step is quantum computing. But surely even quantum computing has its upper limits too, we just don't know them yet. Or, the more likely scenario is that it's not about the finite nature of computing, but the finite nature of the needs of a human or engineer. At a certain point, we will have accomplished all we ever needed. You can't build a faster ship than the Juggernaut, it already travels at light speed. That is the hard limit of physics. Maybe the engineers could keep building increasingly powerful computers, but at a certain point, why bother when the fastest computer is already able to do more than could ever possibly be demanded of it? In this way, it seems the engineers had all they needed and so did away with frivolity, no fashion, no fleeting novelties or trends. No, instead they build things to last centuries or millennia, and their primary focus as a collective is the creation of biological life across the universe. Again, full circle. Maybe they did try to create artificial life and found it somehow lacking or simply not what they wanted. Now they create life, but by using technology to create the organic or biomechanical, as it is the case. I haven't really seen that discussed anywhere, especially not in fiction, the idea that human beings lived in a way that was pretty much the same globally across centuries. It was very much about these basic needs. It was, again, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that it was about food and shelter and clothing and social companionship and all that sort of stuff. And then it's only really in the past century or so, where we get into the technological age, that things start to become very strange, and we're trying all these different things, and not everything works, but we're trying. And, I mean, yeah, you can argue that ultimately those new technologies are still fulfilling desires that were there in primal man, but I do feel like the engineer system kind of makes sense, that we would eventually get to a point where well, we've grown up, the novelty's worn off, you know, we have technology that is functionally perfect and always will be, basically. So culture slows down again and we start thinking in the long term and we think more as a collective, and it's kind of ironic that engineers probably began life like every other species, reproducing, making babies the natural way, and then, you know, got more distracted with technology and all of that. And now they've come full circle and they're actually using that technology mostly just to create life. That's a really neat little system, I like that. Based on the mural we see in the headroom, it is strongly suggested that the Deacon is not the first of its kind. We see another creature in the mural with an elongated body and head. So this is, in a way, the form the mutagen is intended to take. Or at least this particular one. Well, it's hard to say for certain, and one reason why also happens to be a problem society faces today, which is creating symbols that can be understood universally over an indefinite period of time. They're called multi-generational signs. The scenario holds that if we dispose of nuclear waste deep underground, a future civilization might open up that site by accident. Even if you place signs up, there's no guarantee they'll understand it, or worse, they might have the wrong interpretation. For example, why not just put up a skull sign? Universal symbol of death, right? Well, yes, that's the problem. They might think this is an ancient burial ground and want to explore it. Same with the radioactive signs we have now. That could be seen as an abstract symbol for an angel, another common symbol found in graveyards. Really, this could become quite an attractive sign to future archaeologists. Multi-generational warning signs is a really fascinating field of study and a good way to break yourself out of your own biases. You too can become a fair witness if you think about multi-generational signs long enough. In the end, most researchers came to the same conclusion. Just bury it in a place that's hard to access and don't put any signs up, you know. Who is going to find this concrete tomb hundreds of meters below ground? It's just very, very unlikely. So, we cannot rightly say much about what this mural means. But one thing we can say for certain is a xenomorph-shaped creature either existed before the Deacon, or was planned or prophesied. You know, someone had thought of this. Someone had seen this either in reality or in their imagination. We can also say that the fallen engineers were killed by something that burst through their chests from within. So we have a clear demonstration that this is a gestational style that has been featured from early on. The mutagen is wildly unpredictable depending on how it is administered. We see it first taken by an engineer in a relatively large quantity, about a shot glass worth. This is enough to reduce him down to the molecular level, thereby spreading his DNA across the planet. It's not entirely clear how this works. Either A, this is a planet that was already inhabited by complex multicellular life forms, and the mutagen gets into the water and other life forms drink it, and will so be transformed. Or B, this planet has only unicellular life, and the mutagen is now going to transform it into multicellular structures. Or C, maybe there was no life on this planet at all. Maybe they really do just seek planets that happen to be in the right location, the Goldilocks zone, if you will, from their star, or it has water. We really don't know. Presumably the engineer must sacrifice himself so that the mutagen is infused with engineered DNA, and the end result will be humanoid in shape, though I have to wonder why some blood or something else wouldn't have sufficed. This suggests a linear path to evolution, which is of course incorrect. Evolution is merely the result of an organism adapting to its environment. But in this case, every planet will eventually produce an engineer-like creature. Maybe there are also Vulcans and Klingons out there too. How disappointing would it be to be an animal and somehow learn that, sorry, your entire existence was just a byproduct of this massive experiment by aliens, you know? Sorry, tiger, you majestic creature, this apex predator. I don't know, just go die, I guess. You know, these beings are technically your god, but you're nothing to them. You're just an accident or a mistake. But how did life really go from unicellular to multicellular? Normally I don't quote directly from Wikipedia, but I found this really nice, succinct answer. One hypothesis for the origin of multicellularity is that a group of function-specific cells aggregated into a slime-like mass called a grex, which moved as a multicellular unit. This is essentially what slime molds do. Another hypothesis is that a primitive cell underwent nucleus division, thereby becoming a cyanocyte. A membrane would then form around each nucleus, the cellular space and organelles occupied in that space, thereby resulting in a group of connected cells in one organism. This mechanism is observable in Drosophila. A third hypothesis is that as a unicellular organism divided, the daughter cells fail to separate, resulting in a conglomeration of identical cells in one organism. This is what plant and animal embryos do. I would say the implication of the opening scene of Prometheus is more in line with hypothesis 2, the mutagen-caused nucleus division. Kind of fits with the cancerous nature of the mutagen. Now, when administered in other ways, the results are wildly unpredictable. Fifield gets a face full of it, and as a result seems to either survive grievous injuries or is resurrected. He begins to rapidly mutate. He can breathe the harsh atmosphere of LV-223, he becomes savage and animalistic, he gains superhuman strength. Most significantly, his head begins to elongate. Presumably, the unused baby head design is somewhat of an indication of the end result. This is our second indication that the mutagen can change the form of an already developed organism, the first being the hammerpedes. These are unusual because they do not resemble the xenomorph body plan even remotely. What are we to make of this? Does this imply that only certain species are the right foundation or canvas to create a xenomorph? Later generations of facehuggers, of course, will be able to impregnate almost any species and maintain the xenomorph features, including a bull and a gorilla, if the toys are to be believed. Really, anything that isn't too small or too big for a facehugger to latch onto, so elephants and mice are probably safe. Perhaps we can then infer that the mutagen is less desirable as the results are less predictable. After all, if you have one very specific result in mind, why waste your time with millions of accidental offshoots? This bears asking the question. Is this the same mutagen we saw in the beginning of the film? It was equally destructive, but the end product was human beings, xenomorphs. Unless that was the point of the project all along. They seed life on other worlds, and when they have something vaguely human-shaped, they harvest it and turn them into xenomorphs. I could see this happening. Or, alternately, the mutagen can be formulated to create different things. Maybe that's what that mural meant. This place contains mutagen for this kind of creature, the weaponized kind. It's fun to think about engineers because we really don't know that much about them. Next, we see Charlie Holloway infected with a single drop of mutagen. The results are slower and more subtle, but we might assume he would eventually come to resemble whatever Fifield would also have become. And then there's Elizabeth Shaw. This is where things become strange because her infection is secondary. Technically, it isn't an infection at all. This is a parasitism, not unlike what we see in parasitoid wasps. These wasps will find a host and inject its fertilized eggs into the host's body. Usually, this is a larger-bodied creature, like a caterpillar, for obvious reasons. It's roomier. Now, in the case of Holloway and Shaw, something not unlike that occurred. I mean, the trilobite kinda looks like a sperm, at least originally. So, it is unclear if it needed Shaw's eggs or simply needed a womb to develop in. I'm inclined to say the latter, although the former is more tragic because that means this monster is the closest thing she will ever have to her own baby. Much like the wasp larvae, this trilobite does not immediately kill its host, but when the larvae reaches full size, death of the host is the unfortunate consequence. I care about animal welfare as much as the next person, but it fascinates me the difference between how humans aspire to treat animals and the way animals treat each other. Here you have a species that seemingly cannot even reproduce without involving a murder. Reminds me of that line in The Fly. Ever heard of insect politics? Neither have I. I guess the difference between man and animal is that man should know better. Later we see the trilobite grow to enormous proportions. This is surprising given the size of the host it was born from, and also seems incredibly impractical for what is ostensibly only an intermediary phase in the biology of the organism. The larger it is, the more calorically expensive it is to run. We have never had any canonical indication that the xenomorph or related creatures need to eat food, but it must surely be getting energy from somewhere. Otherwise, it's defying the laws of thermodynamics. The other disadvantage of being so large is this thing might be deadly if you get too close, but it's slow and very easy to see. It's like a crocodile, but at least a crocodile can hide under the surface of the water. Trilobites and facehuggers. There's not a simple collective term for them, so I'll call them multicellular gametes. Same number of syllables, but it's just a bit more concise. And I call them that because they have more in common with a sperm or an egg. They are merely the vessel for the DNA that will create the final product. It is debatable whether or not a multicellular gamete is truly alive. It does not need to eat nor sleep, it does not reproduce or make more of itself. It implants an embryo into a host to create an entirely different creature. That's not reproduction. Sperm, too, is technically alive. I mean, the definition of life is debatable. Some virologists argue viruses are alive, too. But in the case of sperm, it can live outside the body. You, and everyone else around you, is a sperm, living its best life outside of the sac. But even in its initial state, or should I say your initial state, it does have some rudimentary way of responding to stimulus and moving around like most unicellular organisms. We can theorize that multicellular gametes operate in much the same way. They may have somewhat higher cognitive function simply based on the fact that they are larger and more complex organisms, but ultimately they are made for one purpose only, and therefore the trilobite is an atrocious design. Form dictates function, and nowhere is this more evident in nature. Much like the parasitic wasp choosing hosts larger than themselves, so too is sperm smaller than an egg, and so too must a trilobite be smaller than its host. Clearly, this was just done for cinematic effect, which, you know, it's a movie. I guess I can't entirely fault it for that. When the trilobite impregnates the engineer, the result, at some indeterminate point later, is the Deacon. This, of course, is made to look like a prototypical xenomorph. But if we apply the real principles of evolution, this is not primitive at all, but the exact creature needed for this environment. Still, one can't help but get the feeling this birth process was unorthodox. I mean, we have two different species as its hosts here. That's probably not how this normally works. The process is also too convoluted. Instead of xenomorph laying eggs and then the resultant facehugger finding a host, we have the additional step of not only the xenomorph needing a host, but the facehugger also needs one too. This is far too risky in nature. The fewer gambles, the better. If only David had been around to witness the Deacon, then we could say for certain that, he saw this accidental process and was inspired by it and decided to streamline it. But he did spend a lot of time in that pyramid, and he can also read what the engineers wrote, so maybe he does know all about it. This begs the question, what happened to the mummified engineers with their chest burst open? As far as we can tell, the only way to get from mutagen to chest burster is vaginally. I mean, you just gotta follow the evidence. Someone is infected with the mutagen, then they engage in intercourse, and the recipient then becomes a host for the trilobite. Seems needlessly complicated, but okay. Also, does it have to be between male and female? Does it have to be vaginal? Can there be butt bursters? Mouth bursters? Inquiring minds want to know. It's fortunate that Shaw is a good Catholic girl, is all I'm saying. Wait, didn't the gay character in Covenant die of a mouth baby? I see. Well, we'll get to that when we get to that. Which is right about now. Alien Covenant is where things start to take a more familiar shape. But first, we begin with the pathogen. Arguably a more dangerous and aggressive form of the passive mutagen, the pathogen can travel freely in the air, essentially making it viral. Liquid is only so effective as a vector of transmission, but an airborne molecule? Absolutely insidious. And to make matters worse, it isn't a virus or bacteria. That would have actually limited its potential. After the first Apollo mission, the crew was kept in quarantine for 2 weeks. The scientists were so convinced of a lunar plague. Half a century later, we understand that the odds of alien bacteria or viruses being in any way compatible with our own biology is profoundly remote. Not to mention how harsh the environment on the moon is. There is no life up there, single-celled or otherwise. I mean, I guess you do have to plan for every single contingency. We did cover this in an early minute about quarantine in space that we really just don't know. There could be planets out there where you've got, you know, symbiotes like Venom that can just adapt to whatever organism it's attached to. The universe is literally infinite, so there are infinite possibilities, therefore. That's how that works, right? Very little is known about the pathogen. Is it merely an aerosol version of the same chemical as the mutagen? It's difficult to say, but when David arrives at the engineer homeworld, he offloads the payload, the ampules we are by now familiar with. But instead of the ampules raining down like cannonballs, they float out like drones. The contents of the ampules unloads mid-air, creating a big swirling cloud of death. It is unclear what happens to the ampules after they release their payload. Maybe they dissolve, maybe they vanish into hammer space under the rule of cool. Immediately this cloud rains down and begins behaving like a swarm of insects, able to chase moving targets and change its trajectory on a dime. Anyone it makes contact with almost immediately dies. Liters of black goo erupts from within them. The carnage is reminiscent of Pompeii, or at least what we think Pompeii would have been like. Now we are seeing a lot of interesting behavior here. The mutagen evidently, when dropped from a great height, will naturally become a pathogen. This seems like what it was designed to do. The implication, since Prometheus, is that these were bombs of some kind. Upon contact with the host, more mutagens produced. Why does this happen? If we look very closely, we also see tentacles and other appendages, perhaps entire creatures erupting from some of these bodies. Is this simply what happens when it is weaponized? Unbridled creation consuming all in its path? One potential answer is that mutagen cannot be created without a host, so maybe the engineers must first wipe out a large population and then go in and harvest the new mutagen. It seems all liquid in the engineer's body turns black. They vomit, they bleed, they cry, and it is all black. Doubtless this has resulted in David, for a time, having plenty of mutagen and plenty of creatures to research and experiment on. In smaller doses, the pathogen works akin to a facehugger. No eggs are required, though they are found residing in these strange fungus-like pod structures. They simply float freely and infect a host, and within minutes a fully formed creature emerges. This is by far the most potent, efficient, and devastating method of xenomorph reproduction. Sure, it lacks the visual horror and looming dread that the classic overmorph facehugger chestburster routine inspires, but this is exactly how an AI would design this system, if indeed David had a hand in it at all. I don't have much to say about the backburster or the mouthburster, except that both result in a neomorph. We are now finally seeing some consistency in the offspring. The xenomorph of Alien Covenant, or as some like to call it, the protomorph. The organism itself is perfect, much like its descendants. However, given what we know about the potency of the pathogen system, we have a bit of a downgrade, and the xenomorph can only be born from an overmorph facehugger system. To save time, I will now refer to this combo as the parasitic gamete system. Honestly, after you've done the pathogen, this just seems dramatic. It's all about theatricality and sadism with David. It's unclear how the unseen creature that killed the ancient engineers in Prometheus worked, but it seems like the parasitic gamete system did not exist at this stage. However, one cannot dismiss the parasitic gamete system outright. The genius of the xenomorph is that it is infinitely adaptable. Lay some already fertilized eggs, presumably asexually, drop them anywhere on the planet and watch them conquer. What disadvantages might the pathogen have? Well, it is invisible, but it is also small. Maybe it was easily thwarted by high winds and rain? It behaves not unlike dandelion dander after all. And the transmission rate seemed pretty damn high for the crew of the Covenant, and they weren't even there for more than a few hours by the time they were infected and the pathogen was dropped on the planet, what, a decade ago? Clearly, much like nuclear fallout, this stuff doesn't go away anytime soon. Perhaps the pathogen is too mindless, affecting anything in its path. It cannot be selective. The facehugger is more sophisticated in this sense. It can observe its target and make a choice. Maybe it avoids hosts with inappropriate body plans or those too feeble to support a chestburster. The disadvantage of the parasitic gamete system is that the overmorph is stuck in place. It must wait for prey to come to it. Once nearby species learn what lies inside these eggs, they will quickly learn to avoid it. A host sticking its face right up to the opening of the egg is only going to happen once if others are around to view it. It is unknown if the facehugger can leave the overmorph and simply go hunting for prey, I see no reason why it isn't possible. If it crawls away and doesn't find a host, it could always return to the Overmorph. It is, after all, a soft, fleshy shell. It seems like it was made for reuse. Now let's focus on the facehuggers. They are a profoundly unique concept. There is nothing like them in nature. The idea of a gamete able to go out into the world and seek a host of its own accord, it's never been done. I don't think it was ever done in fiction before that point either. Sure, we've had an endless series of parasites and symbiotes, but these multicellular gametes are just that. Gametes, not looking to preserve their own life, but to deposit its creator's DNA into another organism. It's reasonable to assume Giga and O'Bannon were thinking of parasites, and in doing so created an entirely new entity. It's kind of subtle in its brilliance because most viewers would accept this alien just planted some eggs in her host. Simple. Only thing is, the babies don't look like Mama, and that's because that ain't the Xenomorph's Mama. Speaking of Mama, let's talk about asexual reproduction. In nature, we see a variety of means of reproduction, and while all mammals and birds reproduce sexually, things get weirder in basically every other class in the kingdom. Sexual or asexual both have their advantages and disadvantages. But the good thing is there are a number of species documented as having switched between these methods, so it's not like they're stuck on one path. And throughout an individual's lifespan, they may actually reproduce in more than one way. However, the xenomorph is not likely to ever have to switch, as it has perfected a method of asexual reproduction that allows for maximum genetic diversity, even outclassing sexual forms of reproduction. It does not matter where the xenomorph is in the universe, if there is life, it can adapt and not only survive, but thrive. In the comics, there is an alien king. He was created through genetic modification by human scientists. He was meant to be more docile, but surprise, he's male, so he's even more aggressive. I do see xenomorphs? I prefer xenomorph as a plural, but apparently it's xenomorphs. I do see xenomorphs as female, and I guess they must at least be closer to female than male, because they have a queen. Or maybe they can change sex, so xenomorphs are sexless, but this trait can be switched on in an alien queen. In nature, we do observe such a phenomenon, as fish can change gender depending on their environment. It is also conceivable that if males did exist in this species at any point, this could re-emerge as a random mutation. So the alien king could well happen by pure chance. Not to mention that xenomorphs take on the trait of their hosts, therefore greatly increasing the chances of such a random mutation. Maybe it has a host from a species that is all male, for instance. Like Bordas in the Orville. The alien queen is clearly inspired by colony insects like ants and bees. However, the life cycle, societal structure, and reproductive habits of these insects are incredibly complex, too complex to spend much time on here. I really went down a rabbit hole, it's fascinating stuff. There are a lot of misconceptions. For instance, not all colonies have a queen. Some even have more than one. And just because they're called queens doesn't mean it's a monarchy. These colonies are a collective, it's more democratic. This is why I hate the Borg Queen concept in Star Trek. It is a collective, not a monarchy. Unless she is a giant Borg popping out babies 24/7, you can shove it. Enjoy that mental image, by the way. And I have to slip this bit of trivia in here because it is buck wild. A male worker ant is called a Gamergate. I shit you not. It was named long before the Gamergate controversy, and it comes from some totally unrelated Greek root word. Something about married worker, I think? Yeah. And this was back in the 80s when it was named. So they were, well, I guess gamer was a concept back then. Well, they weren't called gamers, though. I don't even know when the word gamer began, but I don't think it was the 80s. It's never made entirely clear what authority, if any, the alien queen has over the other xenomorph. Each drone seems perfectly self-reliant. Her duty may have simply been one of reproduction. We actually don't have anything canonically outright stating that the xenomorph reproduce asexually. Maybe a male xenomorph does mate with a queen. However, the implication from the film seems to suggest fertilization does not commence until a host is found for the facehugger. The system is all twisted around, so it's easy to get confused. But essentially, look at my whiteboard here in your imagination. She's essentially laying an egg that contains a kind of sperm type thing, but it is not fertilized. You know, these two gametes cannot produce any offspring together. Okay? And that actually does occur in nature. It's called autogamy, where the gametes of one individual form to reproduce. This is primarily observed in plants. But that's not the case with the xenomorph. Instead, the sperm latches onto a host, and then it drops a fetus into them. When this fetus develops, it is unclear. Presumably, at some point after attaching to the host, the facehugger quickly utilizes the host DNA and assembles an embryo, and then drops it in. It seems unlikely the embryo is initially assembled in the host, so the facehugger is some kind of DNA processing machine. It doesn't need the DNA to come in a neat little gamete package, it just halves it out of the blood of the host and creates an embryo that way. It's astounding the more you think about it. But now we put it that way, is that really asexual reproduction? And what does asexual reproduction mean exactly? There are many forms of asexual reproduction. Fragmentation, for instance, is where a creature severs a part of its body and that part grows into a separate creature. We observe this in starfish and tapeworms. Or unicellular organisms simply split into two in a process called fission. But the kind observed most often in animals is called parthenogenesis, and this is the most relevant one to the xenomorph. This is when an unfertilized egg develops into a new individual and is effectively a clone of the mother. But fertilization does occur on some level during the xenomorph's development. A facehugger cannot fertilize an ovomorph. It cannot make an embryo with only the mother's DNA. Now, it definitely needs a male, so to speak, even if the sex of the host is irrelevant. This should rightly be called an entirely new form of reproduction altogether. It isn't asexual because it requires two participants. It isn't sexual because the female is not impregnated by a male. It's this bizarre amalgamation between sex and parasitism. It never really occurred to me until now just how alien these aliens are. It makes me appreciate them even more. I think as a kid, first seeing Alien and really thinking about it and just going, something about this isn't right. So you got the egg, but then this facehugger comes out and then it lays the baby inside the human. That's confusing for some reason, but I couldn't articulate, and really it wasn't until I started researching this now that I'm going, oh, right. Yeah, this system is so alien, so beyond anything we've ever really known, and it's brilliant. I know David creating the xenomorph is a controversial point, but it is now canon, so we cannot ignore it. However, I think it is also worth investigating what might have been the initial intention in the original series of films. In Alien, it is kept rather vague by design. It's unknown what connection there was between the space jockey and the ovomorphs. In the earlier scripts, it seems like the jockey was just another unfortunate victim. He's the skeleton you see in the pirate movie before our heroes get to the lost treasure. Except this time, there is no treasure. Oh, speaking of multi-generational science, there we go. The space jockey was saying, stay the hell away from here, and the humans read that as a distress beacon, meaning, help, come rescue me. We were given no indication of where the xenomorph came from, if it was native to that planet, if it was natural or synthetic. We knew nothing beyond what we saw, and that was exciting. In Aliens, James Cameron, in my opinion, did a brilliant job of expanding the lore in such an effortless way as to seem like this had always been part of the story. We have a queen. Now we're starting to paint a more detailed picture that changes things retroactively. What are the advantages of a hive? If this is a species designed for conquering worlds, it's a pretty great centralized system. I don't think the way in which the crew of the Nostromo encountered it was what it was designed for. They awoke a random drone. Now we see what happens when the full power of the xenomorph is unleashed. However, the downside from a cinematic perspective is that one xenomorph is deadly. A swarm is just a faceless army waiting to be mowed down. Don't get me wrong, I think Cameron does a good job of preserving just how vicious and deadly they are as foes, but inevitably Alien is always going to be the scarier movie, because we see how devastating just one of these creatures can be. But Cameron was making a war movie, and war movies need an army to fight. And we see that change in reproductive style also reflects the change in genre. Alien 3 doesn't give us anything along those lines, you know, changing aspects of the xenomorph to tie into the themes or the plot of the film. But it does show us for the first time that other species are vulnerable, like dogs, and the resulting creature can take on those traits. Before that, it was easy to assume xenomorphs looked vaguely humanoid by default. However, in early versions of Alien, the xenomorph was meant to take on traits of Kane specifically. Alien 3 returns more to the classic format of Alien. It's smaller and claustrophobic. There are multiple xenomorphs, but this is the happy medium between Alien and Aliens. And that's as many versions of the xenomorph reproductive style that we've seen in the canon, and... Oh, fuck. Alien Resurrection exists, right? Okay. In Resurrection, they are trying to make a clone of Ripley in order to extract the alien queen inside of her, because chestbursters apparently write themselves into your DNA. Unfathomable. Except, no, it isn't. This is what viruses do all the time, and they now play a vital role in our DNA. For example, the human placenta would not even be what it is today without a retrovirus reprogramming our DNA. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and that is very much the case for viruses. Those who survive and develop an immunity might just pass on the next key to our evolution. Nature has a way of balancing things. Obviously, I think death from preventable illnesses is a terrible thing, and of course we should be working on vaccinations and cures and all of that, but it is a fascinating thought experiment to consider, well, so how much do we need these retroviruses? And, you know, if we stopped evolving, what does that mean for us? Or can we still continue to evolve without retroviruses? It's all pure conjecture, we cannot know. And now we live in a civilization, in a society. We don't have environmental pressures on us to change. So we may eventually get to that point where, much like the engineers, we are not evolving due to natural pressures in our environment, but we are using technology like CRISPR to choose for ourselves what form we take. The medical team in Resurrection encounter endless problems. The DNA bleeds into Ripley's, and the end result is a horrific chimera of the two species. At best, they seem to get a perfectly preserved Ripley and chestburster, but one or both die during the extraction process. In the end, the queen from Ripley 8 matures and becomes unlike any queen we have seen before. We see xenomorphs earlier in the film, presumably she was laying those eggs. We see in the scene where that room full of prisoners had facehuggers attached to them. But in the final scene of the film, we see that queen give birth, live birth, on her back, out of a giant opening in her abdomen, and obviously intended to represent a vagina. This queen came from Ripley after cloning, so this blending of species traits is to be expected. The newborn is a sad and disfigured creature. While more powerful than a human by default, given its considerable size, it seems feeble when compared to a regular xenomorph. This is the first time we have witnessed a pathology, a teratology, if you will, in a xenomorph, bearing traits akin to albinism, Down syndrome, dwarfism, and kyphosis, aka the hunchback condition. Despite the infinite adaptability of the xenomorph, it is clear these are not deliberate adaptations, but deformities. It is uncertain how long this creature could survive naturally. It is an abomination of science. In a way, this is humanity overcoming the xenomorph. It might be powerful and lethal. We disfigured it in a way it had no means to compensate for. It's a kind of humiliation. Thankfully, in the real world, scientists are bound by laws and ethics. However, they do grow pig-human hybrid fetuses in order to grow organs. But there are tight regulations in the US, and after 28 days, the fetus must be terminated. However, Nature.com reported last year that, until March, Japan explicitly forbade the growth of animal embryos containing human cells beyond 14 days, or the transplant of such embryos into a surrogate uterus. That month, Japan's Education and Science Ministry issued new guidelines allowing the creation of human-animal embryos that can be transplanted into surrogate animals and brought to term. Calling it now, we're going to end up with a reenactment of the movie Splice, except less sexy, probably. Speaking of sexy, I really was hoping the newborn would actually be a beautiful humanoid creature like in Species. It just made thematic sense to me, tying all those themes of sex, sexuality, and femininity into one awesome female monster. Apparently they did go down this route and decided it was too much like Species and went in another direction. I know a lot of fans weren't happy with the newborn, but I don't know, maybe we should reevaluate its role in this franchise. I believe the design of a good movie monster should say a great deal about the themes of the film, and I think Genet was quite clear in what he was saying with his alien queen and newborn. The message they represent is that mankind conquered the xenomorph and turn it into a pathetic abomination through unchecked science and unrestrained corporate powers. Hooray, humanity, I guess. Honestly, it is actually a fitting end to the Alien franchise. This is as close as it gets to an ending where mankind is victorious. It emphasizes the cruelty all creatures are capable of. Humans are just more sophisticated and sadistic about it. I suppose my fantasy is just addressing different themes and elements of the franchise. Rampant capitalism and corporate greed at the expense of human life has always been a central theme of the Alien franchise from the beginning. But to me, I see Alien as being the one about sex, and Aliens the one about capitalism. High dollar value. Resurrection seems to play up both of these themes, although for a French director, surprisingly not as much sex as you would expect. Studio ADI created the creature and posted a video of the concept art, and some of it is stunning and confronting, and it will make you wonder why they didn't go in those directions. I'll link to that video in the footnotes. I guess what this makes me realize is that what I want is something that's both cool, aesthetically pleasing, but disturbing, much like the original Big Chap. And I guess that's what other fans want too. It's not the concept, it's the execution. The genius of Giger's designs, Giger's art in general, is that it is unsettling, but it's not ugly. There's something very fascinating about it. It's the same feeling I get looking at Junji Ito's artwork. He's a manga artist who does some of the most disturbing horror stories I have ever seen. And I wouldn't say they're ugly. They're disturbing and they get your imagination going, but there's also some weird visual intrigue or appeal, and that's a very fine line to walk, you know. If this newborn was too beautiful, we lose the message of disfigurement and abomination, but too ugly, and it's just, you know, no one wants an action figure of that, it's not something we can connect with. That's the weird irony there, is that even when going back and watching the old Universal horror movies, there's this element in their designs or how these creatures or these characters are personified that they want you to actually feel for them. You know, even Godzilla or King Kong, we're supposed to empathize with them. They're almost the heroes. It's a very strange thing. And I think that's something that the newborn failed at, was creating something that was both visually appealing, disturbing, and also something we could, in a weird way, empathize with. Honestly, I do not envy the designers here. This was a big task. Interesting to note, the concept art seldom makes a newborn, you know, look like an actual newborn. It's never like a little baby chestburster. It needed to be fully grown for plot purposes. It also kind of doesn't work if Ripley can just boot the little guy across the room. That would have, it wouldn't have worked. Clearly, the xenomorph is not natural. While it takes many traits from nature, it is an artificial creation. Nothing this adaptable and powerful could occur naturally. It's as if all of nature and biology's most impressive features were all wrapped up into one shiny black package and accelerated. If it did exist, it really would be the perfect organism, by every metric, in the sense that it is able to defend itself against every predator, and literal predators with a capital P, trademark. It is the most successful hunter, it is the most successful breeder, it seems to be very efficient with its energy. We don't even know what it needs to use as fuel to survive, it might just be oxygen, we don't know. They are practically immortal and invulnerable as far as we can tell. They've basically maxed out every stat. Their methods of reproduction have evolved drastically, and there's no reason to believe this wouldn't continue over time. Personally, given what we've discussed here today, I think the pathogen method is by far the deadliest mode of transmission. But maybe David knows something we don't. It was actually rather difficult to apply conventional wisdom about evolution when this is functionally an alternate reality where evolution possibly does not even occur naturally. That the means by which life can change comes in the form of mutagen or something like that. But then, who created the engineers, you ask? Well, that is not for me to answer in this, the third Alien Day special. I would like to thank Clara once again for inspiring this topic. I was totally stumped on what to write about this year, and this ended up being a really fascinating concept to delve into, and there was a lot there that I hadn't really heard anyone else discussing. No one seems to have really done a deep dive on this, so thank you again. And I would also like to thank my patrons Mark Boda, Tariq, and William Elkhart. If you would also like to become a Patreon supporter, head on over to patreon.com/TravianDesigns. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.